Okay, this afternoon, just by real quick review, we've looked at two dispensations in our study on distinctions, and I'm going to redo our study a little bit for the sake of the kids that we're trying to help, or the kids that we're trying to do this, because first week it went well, and then last week we got a little off. We didn't get off, but I think it was harder for the kids to follow off. So we're going to start off with the first part while we still have the children's attention. We're going to start off at the beginning of this by just doing a quick review of what we looked at. We've looked at the dispensation of innocence and the dispensation of conscience. By the way, what's the main idea of what a dispensation means? Can you say without looking at the answer up there? It's administration, somebody said. And if you were going to tell somebody in two simple words, it's a house rule. Whose house is it?
God's.
And so he has different houses with different rules for those different houses in time. So that's what we're looking at. We're looking at different rules. Now the first people we looked at, we saw last week in the dispensation of innocence that the steward or the manager was Adam. Adam is the steward. The household was Eve. The rule was that they were to tend the garden and don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You can read all that in there. I should make this bigger. Dwight was saying he was running out of room on his sheet already, too. I ran out of room up here, you can plainly see. The failure was that they ate. And the punishment was a series of curses, but they were sent out of the garden. So we have the curses and they were sent out of garden. Then we went to the dispensation of conscience. Adam's oldest son, Cain, was the steward. He was the one that God had given the first instructions with regard to what they were doing. He was the one that God approached on making things right. The family was, or the household was the family of Adam. We don't know what that consisted of. Adam and Eve were around at that time eventually. During some of that, but we know that Cain and Abel were there, and we know that there must have been siblings because Cain was able to marry, you know, and you can't marry if you don't have somebody else to marry. So the rule was that they were to bring sacrifices into God's presence, and the failure was that they honored fallen beings. We call them the Nephilim, these giants. They honored them, and the punishment we saw last week was the flood. Okay. Now we're going to go into the next dispensation, and I want us to go to Genesis chapter 9 when they get off the ark. Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9, and it says in God, I'm going to wait for everybody to get there. Genesis 9 verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, and the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth, and every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive will be food for you. I give all to you as the green plant. In other words, previously, from these two dispensations, they were just eating plants, vegetables. Okay? Now they get to eat meat, too, on top of that. And verse 5, and surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly, and multiply in it. So, who's the manager? Who do you think the manager is? Noah's the manager. Okay, so we start off with Noah. Remember, God's the owner and everyone. We start off with Noah. And who is the household?
Noah's family.
We'll say Noah's family. Okay? But you remember? Pretty much everybody from that point on is going to be part of Noah's family, aren't they? Is Noah your great-grandpa? Somewhere in the past, yes. Okay. Okay. The rule of the house. Okay. The rule of the house. We've got a couple different rules. One of them is multiply. We'd say be fruitful and multiply. So I'm just going to abbreviate that. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. Number one.
is the rule.
The second rule, he tells them that they can eat meat. I don't know if we'd say that that's a rule, but he tells them they can eat meat. But then the next rule that he tells them there is that he is going to require the blood of anybody who is killed. He's going to require that from other people. What is that? When you... We call that capital punishment. And we just looked at that this morning. What does capital punishment belong to?
Law.
To what?
Law.
Belongs to law, but specifically what law? Who controls the law or makes the law?
Government
does. That's why we call this human government. As I said, when we look at these are the only three that have specific titles. So when we look at these back here, we're looking generally at what we see. I would never really argue with the person that said human government. I don't know if that's appropriate. But I do think that that probably does give us as good of an idea of what's going on. So we'd say multiply, and then I'm just going to put CP for capital punishment there, which really is the, as we saw this morning, Romans 13, that's the arm and authority of human government, okay, which is put in place by God, okay? I'm abbreviating into CP because I ran out of a lot of space here last week. Okay, so multiply, fill the earth, and to exercise capital punishment. Everybody has those? Okay. Now, we haven't seen the failure yet, so let's turn over to chapter 11. And first of all, let's go to chapter 10. We've got two examples of failure. Now, it says in verse 8 of chapter 10, now Cush became the father of Nimrod. Now, we haven't looked at this in the study here today, but Cush is from the family of Ham. And that is important because Ham was supposed to be the servant to the other brothers. And yet they made his son Cush actually becomes the father of the one that's going to be a ruler. So Cush became the father of Nimrod. If you don't have a study Bible that already puts it, the word Nimrod literally is we will revolt or we will rebel. And he became a mighty one upon the earth. Okay? Now, that's the way most of your English Bibles read, but it is also a very legitimate translation to say he is a hunter of the mighty in the earth. Now, we're going to explain that. Verse 9. He was a hunter of the mighty, going with the same Hebrew translation, a hunter of the mighty before the Lord. Okay? Now, we're talking about verse 8 and 9.
What chapter?
Chapter 10, Genesis 10. Now, verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And we're taking mighty with those that are before the Lord. We're making it the object of hunter. We're not making it a modifier of hunter. And that's very legitimate in the Hebrew. And in fact, this isn't anything obscure. I've got a number of commentaries that go this route. That what they essentially are telling you is that Nimrod becomes one that hunts down people who are mighty before God. In other words, we'd say God's strong ones, he hunted down. You get the picture? In other words, what was the goal of human government initially? To punish those who killed others. What did Nimrod begin doing? Hunting down God's people. See? Essentially... And what do you do when you hunt?
You kill.
That's right. You put them to death. You know, it's not like people that say, oh, I'm a hunter with my 35 millimeter. You know, there's people that used to do that and they go, yes, I'm going on a photographic safari. You know, except when I was growing up, you know, you guys, some of you remember this, maybe Dan remembers it, American Sportsman Sunday afternoons, you know, watching those guys go on safari. They were never shooting pictures. Okay. When you'd watch that. And that's what Nimrod was doing, except he was doing it with God's people. And then notice what it goes on, and it says, the end of verse 9, therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a hunter of the mighty before the Lord. Verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now think about that. The beginning of Nimrod's kingdom is Babel. Is Babel ever good? No. So if you just even working back logically, how is it that Nimrod could be a mighty hunter before God? And yet set up a kingdom that's bad. Let's see. I mean, the whole logic of all of it is you have government established here under Nimrod, and it's a government that's opposed to God, and he's opposed to God because he's actually hunting down God's people. Next thing, chapter 11. Let's look at what this Babel looks like. Because all, because what chapter 10 is a genealogy, okay? It's just telling us who begat and who begat and who begat, but it gives us some interesting little sidelights of things that happen in those genealogies. And it stops with Nimrod there and focuses on him for a little while because Nimrod was a significant character. Now we come to chapter 11. It says in verse 1, "Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let's make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar." Okay, so they're sticking their bricks together with tar. "And they said, 'Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top," now my Bible says, "will reach into heaven." Literally, its top is in heaven. Because remember, they're building the top of this tower not so that they could walk up there and by walking up actually walk into what we would call heaven, but for the purpose of being able to go up that tower and communicate with God. The same reason that a lot of religions built tall structures, because they thought it gave them a communication point somehow or another with heaven. And so that's what they're building. And then notice it says, "And let us make for ourselves a name." Now, how do you make a name for yourself? You have to do something that makes you famous, right? I mean, it's interesting. In the last dispensation, you had people that made a name for themselves, didn't they? They were the Nephilim, the fallen ones. These guys also want to make a name for themselves. And it says, "Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." In other words, their very point is, we don't want to do what God said. God told us to spread out over the earth and fill the earth. We don't want to do that. We all want to stay together. No, that was Noah when he got off the ark at Noah 9. It said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." See, so they were to fill the earth. Well, how?
Stay in one place.
Yeah, not stay in one place. How do you fill the earth if you're all staying together? In other words, we could do that, couldn't we? All of us that are over here on the east side, we could all move to the west side and we could crowd into Seattle. It wouldn't be any fun, but you could do that. We could all stay there and say, hey, if we all crowd together, we could form a city and make a name for ourselves instead of scattering out over the face of the earth. So that's what they're doing. They want to make a name for themselves. They do not want to scatter abroad over the face of the earth. And that's what it says in verse 4, "Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." They don't want to do that. So they build this. So what's the failure? The failure is, first of all, that they have a leader who, and I'm going to have to spell this one out and make it longer, but the leader who kills God's people. They have a leader who kills God's people. And second underneath there, they form a city. Form a city so as not to scatter. They don't want to scatter. They want to stay together. That's what they want to do. So they form a city. I'm probably writing this too small. I needed to do this bigger. I'm sorry about that. But they form a city so as not to scatter. I mean, their very purpose, both of these things that go on here are contrary to what God said. Up here, he told them capital punishment and multiply and fill the earth. They come down and they go, well, we'll practice capital punishment. We'll kill God's people. We won't kill people who are shedding blood. We will shed the blood of those who are honor God, who are God's strong ones. And we won't scatter. We will actually form a city. Okay? We'll actually form a city. We'll stay together. We'll multiply, make a name for ourselves. So what does God do? What's the punishment, right? We're down to punishment here on this dispensation. And it says, verse 5, "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people. They all have the same language. This is what they began to do. And now nothing that they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth." See, he scatters them. He forces them to do what he told them to do in the first place. And they stopped building the city. And therefore, the name was called Babel, which meant confusion, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now there's one other thing I want you to see. First of all, God confuses the languages and divides the people. But the other thing I want you to see, if you go back up into chapter 10 in the genealogies, we have another man that's mentioned in verse 25. And it says, and two sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now, it's always important when you're reading genealogies or you're reading even in the historical books, and you've got these little side notes that come up once in a while where you have little things like this. We look at that and we go, oh, the earth was divided in his name. We don't think anything about it. And yet those side notes are actually very important, because every time God throws those in, there's something there he wants you to catch. That's why he bothers telling you. I'll give you another example of a kind of a side note that's unusual. What? A woman's name. Oh, my wife knew what I was going to talk about. Yes, back over in Genesis chapter 4, when you have the world system developing under Cain. Remember, Cain builds a city and the world system develops. You have the name of some of the boys, the different boys of the different family members there, right? And it tells you why. We've been over this before. But it also names the name of a daughter. You don't have very many women named in the Old Testament, and very seldom do you ever name their daughters. You know why hers is important there? Because her name was Naamah. And Naamah meant beautiful. And we go, well, what's the matter with that? Well, I think what it does is that word, it's actually kind of orderly beauty. The idea and the significance of it was, is in the world system as it develops, it places on women primarily an emphasis on beauty. So that, I mean, we live in a world that still is like that, isn't it? Doesn't the world tell you women how you're supposed to look? You're supposed to look like this. You're all supposed to be a cookie cutter, have your hair the same way, wear makeup the same way, your eye the same way. You're all supposed to have the same figure, wear the same clothes, you know. And if you don't fit into that mold, see, and that's what the world system wants. It tells you what beautiful is, okay. So it's always interesting when you have these side notes. Well, what's the significance of the side note in 10:25? Well, first of all, it says in his days the earth was divided. And earth here is not referring to men. It's not referring to people being divided. It's talking about the physical ground being divided. The Eretz, the very land itself being divided. And second of all, the word divide in that verse is the name of the man. This is why he was called Peleg. He was born, and while he was in his days, the earth was being divided, and his dad goes, I'm going to call you Peleg, because the earth is being Pelegged. It's being divided. Now, the word Peleg actually occurs in other places in Scripture, and it means to divide or split by water. Now, there are places where there's a cognate of this word. Cognate is another form of the word, where it refers to canals, okay, or ditches. And there are some people that come to this and seen that it is the word Peleg. They said, well, in his days, the canal systems were developed. Which you kind of have to ask yourself the question, why does God want me to know that canal systems were developed during the life of Peleg? But see, I don't think that's what he's talking about. What he's talking about here, if you fit it in with what happens down in chapter 11, because chapter 10 overlaps chapter 11. It's not chapter 10 happens and then chapter 11 happens. Chapter 10 is the genealogy that overlaps chapter 11. And so it's up there, while these people's voices or languages are being confused and they're being scattered, verse 25 occurs. A man has a son named Peleg. And he calls him Peleg, divided by water. Because what happens is at this time, this is what the earth looked like. Just exactly like that. It was red and, no. But just picture, the earth looks something like this. And what happens is these people form this tower called Babel, and God confuses their languages, and they scatter out throughout the land. And once they have begun to scatter, once they've begun to move out, God splits this land apart so that you begin to have what we know as the continents. Okay? In other words, contrary to physical science, continental drift has not taken place over the course of millions and millions of years. According to the book of Genesis, These continents were split and divided in one man's lifetime. God caused them to be. And everybody goes, well, we still have continental drift. They're still moving. Well, it's one of my friends used to say, they're like now, they're standing with a speed gun and clocking the speed of somebody as they are rolling up to a stop sign. At a stop sign, are they doing the same speed they were doing out on the highway? No, see? So when they're clocking the speed, see, it's slowing down. And that's what they're doing today. When they measure it now, they're measuring the continents coming to slowing down, okay? Now, if you remember your earth science in school, I remember learning about continental drift when I was in earth science in junior high and in ninth grade. I thought it was very fascinating. But, I mean, I grew up, the thing that was fascinating to me is I had a pastor that taught that continental drift happened in the Bible. I had this, I listened to, there was a science guy I listened to when I was growing up as a kid, but I was probably fourth or fifth grade. So by the time I had continental drift in school, I'd already been taught it out of the Bible, see, when I was growing up. And that's, but I didn't know the Hebrew at that time. I didn't understand this as well as I understand it now, but I was able to understand then. So God divides the people over the earth, and then divides, different word now, Peleg, divides the land itself. Okay, so how did the people get over here in the United States and everything that they did? In fact, see, these are some of the things, if you read about earth science and how people groups got over here, they have a tough time trying to figure out how these people got over there and when did they cross over here and things like that. And it's real interesting. I was reading a book that says that people actually came over here much more recently than they thought. They used to think it was further back. And they found other people that were over here in what we would call the Americas prior to even some of these people supposedly having come over on the land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. Okay. All of that, simply to say that this is what happens. This splitting of the continents in the Hebrew is Peleg. Okay. I've got to teach this at public school one day because I taught for Ben Orth one day years ago in earth science, and they were talking about continental drift in here, and he goes, what's the Bible's take on this? And so I actually said, I actually told the kids, I was just gutsy, I said, you know, even the Bible talks about that, and I said, this is, I didn't do that right. I said, that's the word that's used in there, it talks about Peleg, it talks about the earth being divided. Peleg. Okay, and I went out, and some of those eighth graders were like, wow. Some of them are like, you know how that goes. Okay, let's answer the last question. So what's the punishment? Punishment here is confusion of languages. So confusion of language, number one.
Scattering by dwelling.
Scattering people. You have to kind of go by what I say, because if you can read this, you actually deserve a S superior A. Scattering people, and then what was the last punishment?
Split land.
I'm just going to say split land. Right. Shorten it up, okay? So that's what happens. And so ends with Babel, so ends dispensation number three. Noah's the manager, his family, all these descendants. They're the household. They were to multiply, and they were to practice capital punishment. But their failure was they made a leader who killed God's people, and they formed a city so as not to scatter. So they specifically disobey God, and God punished them by confusing their language, scattering the people, and splitting the land. Okay, and it's real interesting. I was listening to Dave Hunt. I don't know how many of you know who Dave Hunt is. He does a thing called the Brian Call, and he has a radio show out of Eugene, Oregon and such. But I was listening to him a few years back. And he actually flew on an airplane. He was looking through one of those airplane magazines. And there was a major, one of your top 100 companies in the world that was actually, and they're involved in computers and stuff. And their big logo that they had across the top had underneath it in bold print, it said, Undoing the Babel Effect. I remember him saying that. Which to me makes sense. Isn't that what the world's been trying to do ever since? Back then, they've been trying to figure out some way to unite. And interestingly enough, I think out here in the millennial, or in not the millennial kingdom, but in the tribulation, that's exactly what they're going to try to do again. Is they're going to try to unite against God. Now we come to the next dispensation, the dispensation of promise. The dispensation of promise starts, if you would, at the end of chapter 11. End of chapter 11, look with me at verse 27. It says, these are the records of the generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram. Now we know him as Abraham. Nahor, Haran. Haran became the father of Lot. So you can kind of see how Abraham and Lot are connected in this context. And Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldees. Ur is south of what we would know as Babylon, over there in the Middle East. And Abraham and Nahor took wives for themselves, the name of Abram. Abram's wife was Sarai, the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Go to chapter 12 now. So we have Abraham and Sarah, and we kind of see where they're at. They're over, if you drew the Middle East, if you draw the Middle East like this, here's Spain, there's, what's that, Kate?
Italy,
good. Okay. We were playing a game the other day, and she was trying to get us to guess the bike ride in France, but she had to make this because how do you draw France? So she just had to get us over in that region. She was pretty smart. Here's Greece. Here's Turkey. There's Israel. Okay. So somebody, my dad used to teach geography, and he wanted to show students how you could draw the world with simple shapes and such like that. North Africa. Then we have Egypt's down here, we have the Red Sea, and we have this big piece of ground over here. And down over here is probably roughly where Ur of the Chaldees was at. Babylon would have been a little bit north of there. And this region across here was called the, remember your? Okay, but there was a what?
Fertile Crescent,
yeah, okay. This is called the Fertile Crescent, primarily because it falls along the river and there was a lot of farming around there, because all this, remember, is just sand, okay? So he's over here on the far side of this desert is where Abraham and his family are, and God wants to bring them over here to this little teeny piece of land, which actually in all of this probably is only about that big. That's not even probably to scale, but by any means. Okay, so verse 12, it says, and the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house, to a land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all families of the earth will be blessed. So, who's the steward in this house?
Abraham.
Who's the household?
Abe's family.
Okay. Now, if we want to be really fussy about this, what restrictions do you have to make to Abraham's family to be part of the household?
Descendants of Sarah.
Descendants of Sarah, and then descendants of Jacob, his grandson. See? Because remember, God, it's not going to be through Ishmael. And did Abraham have other children? Remember after Sarah died, he remarried. He actually took a couple concubines, which all that meant were secondary wives. It just meant they weren't primary wives. And he had a whole bunch of other children from them. But remember, towards the end of his life, he gave gifts to all the other children and sent them away. And he says, Isaac is the boy. He's the one of promise. Of course, by that time, Isaac would have been an older man by far. And gives him.
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob.
So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then from Jacob on, then the rest of the family. See? But that's why we just have to say, but this is unique because back here, it was everybody. Adam and Eve, that's not a lot of people, but it was everybody. Here, it was everybody, right? Here, it's everybody. But now, this is the first time we have a restriction in the family. It's only going to be the family of Abraham. And then it's not even going to be all the family of Abraham. It's going to be just the family of Abraham through Isaac. And then just the family of Isaac through Jacob. So you have this real interesting setup for how this comes out. So there's the family. Now, what was the household rule, essentially? What's he say? Go to a land. He's going to take him to a land. And he basically makes promises. And that's pretty much it. What do we call that? When he tells you, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to make you great, and I'm going to bless you. Now, was Abraham saved in Genesis 12? No, he's not saved until Genesis 15. He's not saved until 7 years later. So God even, this is interesting, God starts this dispensation with an unsaved man. In fact, it's over in the New Testament, we're told, you know what Abraham was? What was his family? They were idolaters. They were idol worshipers. And he takes an idol worshiper and pulls Abraham out. And then you find out, did Abraham just hop to it when God told him to hop to it? See how well you know. No, actually, the book of Acts tells you they went up north. They went up in here. They settled up in Haran with the family. And he stayed up there until his father Terah died. And when his father Terah died, then he headed down south. If you read the Genesis account, it looks like he just took off, went up through Haran, and came down. But Acts tells you that there was a long pit stop up north before they ever made it down to the land of the Canaanites. Okay.
So does it tell us how many years that was?
I don't know that it does tell us how many years, but there was a little bit of time, because it doesn't actually tell us how old he was, if I remember correctly. Terah was 205 years when he died, but I don't know if it tells us actually how old. Oh, Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So we know how old he was when he left Haran, but we don't know how old he was back here when he was down in Ur. See, so we don't know how old he was the first time God appears to him. But it's real simple. God says, go to a land, I'm going to give you a land, and I'm going to bless you. And oh, really, so let's put it this way. What do you have to do with a promise? What's your response to a promise?
Believe it.
Believe it. Your promise is to believe it. Let me ask you a question. Does God tell Abraham that there's anything that he has to do to get the land? Well, there is. He's got to go. He has to go. I mean, if he believes that God's going to give him the land and he still sits, he just sits on his thumb, sits on his hands there, he's obviously not going anywhere, is he? He's just sitting on his hands. So he does have to go, but that's the way he's going to express belief. So he's going to leave he's going to leave where he's at. He's going to go to the land, and that's going to be belief. Okay. Now, did Abraham go? Abraham went very slowly, but he did go. Then God repeats the promise to Isaac. He repeats the promise to Jacob. Jacob, in turn, repeats the promise to Jacob's sons, to his 12 sons. But where are Jacob's sons when Jacob repeats the promise to the sons? They're all in Egypt. So they're all down here in this land now, which is not the land of promise. The land of promise is up here. So these men have to be living with the promise that they're going to go back. So turn to Genesis 15 for just a minute. I'm really trying to move this along because I don't want to get quite as bogged down as we did last week. I'm sorry. So I'm trying to move a little bit faster. But it says in verse 18, it says, and on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Now a covenant, we've already been over covenants. But all a covenant is a form of a promise. Okay, I can make a promise where my wife says, are you going to go to town today? And I say, yeah. She goes, I want you to pick up for me socks. And I say, I'll get you socks. If I say, I'll get you socks, it's a promise. I don't even have to say it, I promise. You just say, I'll do it. Sort of, in a sense, it's a promise. But if she took down a piece of paper and says, I, Tim, promise to get Peg socks under pain of great scolding if I don't do it, or something like that. That would be a contract, right? I don't know what, I couldn't think of anything else. I don't know what you'd do if a person didn't get socks for you. But if you go and buy a car, what do you do?
Talk about food, then.
Oh, yeah, I won't feed you. Yeah, there we go. But if you went and bought if you go buy a car, and if you buy it the way most Americans do, which means that you don't pay outright for it, you buy it on time, then you're signing a contract saying, I agree to pay you this much every month, and if I don't, then you have the right to come and repo my car, right? That's a promise that you're signing, but we call it a contract. And a contract, putting this up here, contract is very similar to, I wouldn't say it's absolutely identical to, but it's very similar to, or nearly similar to, covenant. In fact, I think if you do mathematical symbols, isn't that the way you do it? Mm-hmm. Almost equal to, or something like that? Yeah.
What?
Isn't that approximately? But
yeah. It's approximately a covenant, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's not absolutely equal to, but it's approximately. So that contract is approximately equal to a covenant. Okay, it's what you're talking about in here. And the reason we say that, because God's going to make a series of four covenants to Abraham and his family. So, he says in here, verse 18, after he says, covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I've given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, and he tells him all these different things. But I want you to go back up now, before he gives that covenant, and he says in verse 15, and as for you, that's Abraham, you shall go to your fathers in peace. What does that mean, you go to your fathers in peace?
Die.
You're going to die, okay, Abraham. And you shall be buried in a good old age. And then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the perversity of the Amorite is not complete. So he's actually, in fact, we should have said back up in verse 13, I didn't go up far enough. He says, know for certain your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. Now they're there for 400 years, they're slaved and oppressed apparently for the four generations, and that's down here, that's in Egypt. But those people have to believe the promise that God made here in a form of a covenant that God's still going to take them to that land. See, Abraham had to believe it, Isaac had to believe it, and even those relatives that are down in that land have to believe that God's going to take them out of Egypt and bring them back up to that land. Now, turn your Bibles to the book of, book of Numbers. Because I really think this is ultimately where the failure's at. You can see, I think the failure is in Exodus 19 when they say everything the Lord has said we will do, but I think this is more the failure than anything else. Numbers 14. Actually, I want you to go to Numbers 13 and you can all listen to this. We're going to start with verse... It'd be interesting to read all of this. But in Numbers... where we're at in the book of Numbers, they've come up to a place called Kadesh Barnea, which is on the south edge of this land. They've sent spies into the land, a spy from each one of the tribes, and they send them in there. The spies come out of the land, it says in verse 25 of chapter 13. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation, and they showed them the fruit of the land. Remember? What was the fruit of the land? It's actually just above here a couple of verses, but what was it?
Grapes.
A cluster of grapes that had to be carried out by two men carrying them on a pole. Can you imagine having a cluster of grapes that huge? And they told them, verse 27, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey. Now that doesn't mean that there's milk coming down there. As a kid, I never could get this picture. This used to really confuse me as a kid. All that means is it was really fertile land. You want to farm ground? You know what it's like to farm someplace where you don't have to work that hard? That was the whole point. This was really easily farmed ground, okay? And so he says, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak. Amalek is living in the land of Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of Jordan. And Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. But all the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out. The land through which we have gone and spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. See, so they don't tell the rest of the people the full story. They tell the leaders the true story. But the rest of the people, they say, oh, it's a horrible place. It devours its people. And all the people whom we saw were men of size. Now that's what back up in verse 28, the descendants of Anak, that's what the Anak were. The Anakim were Nephilim. And we saw what Nephilim were last week, didn't we? They were giants. They were big people. And there were big people in the land. Because you know what one of the descendants of the Anakim were? There was a man and his four brothers. What was that man's name? Goliath, who was 9 feet tall, and he had four brothers, and they were all big guys. By the way, how many stones did David take up out of the brook?
Five.
It seems like he was kind of thinking maybe he was going to have to take on all five of those boys if he was going to, and he actually only had to take on Goliath. They are great size. Verse 33, and they also saw, we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. See, and we looked at the Nephilim last week, right there. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. Well, if you were up against guys that were one of these guys in the land, remember his name was Og, king of Bashan. Remember how tall, how long I told you his bed was last week?
13 feet long.
That tells you how big this guy was. You know, he doesn't have a 13-foot long bed because he plays football in it. He's got a 13-foot long bed because he's tall. He's probably 12 and a half feet. See? Then that's a big guy. The ceiling's 8 feet in here, about. So you think about another 4 to 5 feet above the ceiling. That'd be intimidating. But that's what it tells you they were. Then verse 1 of chapter 14, then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? By the way, I want to see if you remember a little bit of your history. When he was going to give them the land, were they ever going to have to actually fight battles if they went into the land?
No.
What was God going to use?
Hornets.
Hornets. Remember we sing that hornet song?
Yeah.
God said, I would have sent hornets into the land and he would have driven out. Could you imagine if you would have had an infestation of hornets? How many people would stick around if you had hornets stinging people all the time? God would have supernaturally used hornets to drive them out. And he says, you won't even have to fight. You'll walk in, their houses will already be built, their crops will be planted, their vineyards will be there, and you just go in and take over. See? You just pick up where they left off. That's what God told them they were going to do, would have had to do. But because they didn't obey when they actually went into the land, what did he make them do? He made them have to fight. Yeah, they had to fight wars.
Well, they had to wander the wilderness first.
They had to what?
Wander the wilderness.
Yeah, they had to wander the wilderness for 40 years before they actually get it. Exactly. Verse 4, so they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. They're going to go back. By the way, I don't know if you know this, I was just reading it, but I think that they were at Sinai for a little over 2 years. I was just reading it just a couple weeks ago. So this has been about 2 years since they left Egypt, roughly, by this time. But they're going to go back. Can you imagine they've been away from Egypt for 2 years and they're thinking, we'd like to go back to that place. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel, and Joshua the son of Nun, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of these who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. They spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. And if the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into the land and give it to us. Notice what it says. He'll do it. We're not going to have to do it. He will do it. A land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, for they are our prey. Their protection or their defense has been removed from them. In fact, it's real interesting. We talked about, they said there's fortified cities in the land. What example do we have of God demolishing a fortified city when they actually took the land?
Jericho.
And did they have to do any fighting to actually defeat the physical city itself? No, God brought that down. Then all they had to do was, once God brought the wall down, is run in and kill everybody that was in the city. That was easy to do. Can you imagine going into, if a city had just been bombed like that, and the walls had tumbled, the chaos that would be in there, it would be easy to go in there and do battle, wouldn't it? And so he says, there has been removed, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Notice that the Lord is with us. Verse 10, but all the congregation said to stone them with stones. They're going to stone Caleb and Joshua. And then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. It's interesting, Joshua and Caleb and their families are the only ones that, out of these people that stood here, that got to go into the land, except for those kids and such that were under 20. But they get to go in there. Think about that. I don't know how old Caleb is at this time. Probably in his 30s or perhaps 40. They're going to wander for 40 years. Caleb goes in there and he leads people in battle. He's got to be in his 80s or close to it. And yet he was leading people in battle up in the hill country. and such. Which is kind of an exciting thing to think about, because he was still, 40 years later, even after wandering the wilderness for 40 years, he was still convinced God would give him the land, so much so he was ready to lead battle, and he did. And you can read that, of course, over in the book of Joshua. But so the failure, their failure here, when we come to this, at this point, their failure is what? They don't believe. They were supposed to believe, but they don't believe. This isn't belief for salvation. We're not talking about saving faith. We're talking about faith in a promise that God would give them the land. That's what this was. And they refused to believe that promise. They said, God can't give it to us. And so the judgment on this dispensation judgment is going to be
wandering and they have a fight shoot.
They're going to wander. They're going to have to fight for the land. In fact, it's real interesting. Due to their disobedience, they actually ended up fighting off and on for their land during almost all of their history in that land. And one other thing, what do they actually get now? In order to get the blessings God promised them in the land that they would have had under Abraham, what do they have to do now? They have to obey the law. He gives them the law, and they have to obey the law. You realize before they would have taken the land, they wouldn't have had to go through all those commandments and everything. But now in order to have, if you want to have a good crop, you got to obey. If you want to have good cattle, you got to obey. If you want to have healthy kids, you got to obey. Before that, God never told them, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of rules, and if you do these things, you'll get the land. Now, he did tell them that at Sinai, but I believe that at Sinai in Exodus 19, we didn't really go over it, but I'm just going to say, I think that's their first step in unbelief. Because that's when God says to them, are you going to keep or guard my covenant, which is this. They all asked them, and they said, everything the Lord says, we'll do. They hadn't been able to do anything God had said. They failed at every step. And I think that was their presumption. And because they presumed they could do what God wanted when they got out there to the actual at Kadesh Barnea, because they'd been presuming they could do it, they get in the land and they look at it, we can't do that. See, we can't defeat them. Instead of back at if in Exodus 19, they would have said, hey, we haven't been able to do anything, but God will get us there. We're just going to let God get us there. I'm sure then they would have stood with Caleb and Joshua and said, we can't defeat these guys, but God can. So they actually set themselves up for this very problem starting way back in Exodus 19, which was about 2 years earlier. Okay, about 2 years earlier. Okay. Any questions on any of this we went over today? Tried to move along a little bit faster. Tried not to bog down quite as much, but no? Let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we're thankful for your word, every part of it, whether it's those parts that we live by or those parts that we agree that are true. We're encouraged by these things because these people set examples that we actually learn from. And we realize that there are promises that you've set before us, promises that you fully intend to accomplish, and yet sometimes we fail, like Israel, to believe those things because we allow what look like insurmountable circumstances in life to get in our way. And yet you've asked us not to ever let those things get in the way. We're to be people that don't doubt, but people that believe, because your righteous ones will live by faith. And Lord, we are righteous in Christ. We ask that you might help us then to be those who would indeed walk by faith in the promises that you have made to us. And we thank you for it then. Amen.
Okay, remember next week is Ordinary.